Hey, Mike, what were you ordering oatmeal in a Waffle House? You're supposed to order the sausage.
Careful, sir. I was trying to be careful with my fat intake.
I hear you. Okay. Well, we picked the wrong place, didn't we?
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, I didn't want to say anything because I was being polite. I wanted to be, I think some of the people don't realize some of the best jokes in this country were conceived at 3 o'clock in the morning at a Waffle House.
There you go.
There's no question about that. That's where the stand-up comics meetings take place.
Okay.
Not to reveal anything about the business, but I'm breaking down the fourth wall. But that's where we sit down and have some of the best conversations and tell the best stories about.
Nice. You want to meet after the show at Waffle House, Mike?
John, I actually have some things to do.
Mike, I'll treat you to oatmeal at Betty's. I gotta grab breakfast after this.
Hey, John, I respect you. Yeah. I think you're just wonderful and you're funny, but a stand-up, you are not. So,
I'm sorry,
John. You won't be able to make it.
I mean, it might be funny just watching me eat.
We'll make exceptions for Zaki and Dr. Wish, but John, you're not.
Okay. All right, pal. Hey, let's listen to Dr. Wish for a moment because we have some.
I'm gonna jump off of here and let you guys do your thing. And,
all right,
and
buddy.
I appreciate again you letting me call in, John. I thank you so much for putting up with my insults.
That's okay. I thrive on them.
Hey, Mike.
I'm gonna invite you over to an all butter dinner.
Hey, Mike. Happy post apocalypse.
Yeah. Yes, everyone enjoy themselves prior to this thing going on in North Korea. Have fun.
Yeah. Okay. You too. Bye. Good Lord.
Bye, fine, Mike.
Anyway, good morning, Dr. Wish.
Well, this is gallows humor. Sometimes you just can't change things, so you may as well laugh.
That's right.
Absolutely.
A few zippy lines on the way to the hangman, right? But, I think that I don't think the stress level has gone down since we talked to you last.
I don't think so either. It seems that in my lifetime, there's always been some really nutty, unpredictable leader of a country.
Right.
Yes.
Well, now we have several.
Yes, that's right.
Including our own.
Well, you look at Kim, what's the guy's name? Who's the North Korean dude's name?
Kim Young-sung.
Kim Young-sung. Kim Young-sung. Okay. Come on. Are you
something
sure?
Like that.
Okay, all right. Well, something like that. All right. And Donald Trump, or his press secretary, and, you wonder, okay, is there any point in reporting anything anymore?
Right.
Practically, because all of it just seems to be posturing. I mean, when I heard, it's on the headlines this morning, that the big picture of the fleet being sent to North Korea, turns out it was going somewhere else.
Right.
But nonetheless, it's set
They're
up.
They're headed to Australia.
Blah, blah, right. Blah, big, sucker bait. It's like a giant example of sucker bait, which is how he won the election anyway.
The Armada. Yeah, our Armada is headed that way. And it wasn't.
But, not that I expect the military to tell us, what they're doing all the time. But nonetheless, when you straight out just make a big showboat lie out of it. What's the point of reporting on it? You don't even know. When you report on it, you don't know what you're reporting on. It must be like, you finish a meeting at the North Korean Central Committee or something like that, and you say, well, we discussed the following 40 things. Well, which one of them are we going to report on? None. We're going to report on, geese flying south or something. And it's kind of like a little bit like that.
Well, there's too much news. You see, the problem is, one of the many, many problems is there's too much news on your TV, on the internet, and every talking head is jockeying to say something memorable and relevant. And after a while, there's only so many things to say, and there's only so many ways to say it. And so you have to fill time. The news is now 24/7. It's terrible. So it's no surprise to me, that fake news gets in, that exaggeration gets in, that things that might be happening get into the news. It's terrible. I can't listen to the news all day long, and there are people who do.
Yeah, it's true. No, I don't do it. I never actually did that. every time I'd start listening to the news, you know, I would at some point I just couldn't anymore, and I'd put on a book on tape, and that was much better. So, but nonetheless,
you know, I get up very early in the morning, and I have a routine that most of the time I follow. There's usually, you know, if I don't, it's some exception, like I have to go to the doctor's or something or whatever. And so the first thing I do is I have about 20 minutes that I do in the bed of, like, yoga lattes. It's like a routine because mm-hmm. I have a bad back, so I have to strengthen that. But it's good for you anyway.
But it's a good thing to do early, yeah. My wife, Carol, does. She does that in the morning, yeah.
Yeah, my core is really strong, and I just like to keep it that way. So I don't turn on the news. My husband wakes up, and the news goes right on. And there's no way I can do that. I want to wake up laughing and smiling. So I watch reruns of I Love Lucy.
Oh, boy. You had to go about that far back to find something?
I did. To make sure that it's not all this other stuff in it and political correctness and topical stuff. No, it's just crazy. It's crazy, and I laugh. I've seen these so many times, I always laugh.
My mother's, she had one vaudeville routine, or kind of vaudeville routine, that she liked to do if she'd had at Christmas time or some or other, you know, celebratory moment. And that was to reenact Lucy's Vita Vita Vegemin act.
Oh, that's wonderful. It's just wonderful. That and the about a week ago, I saw the one with the candy on the conveyor belt. That was just wonderful. Right. I mean, it's, at any rate, you know, you have to take charge of your own life. That's the message. Take charge of your own life. It's not a law that you have to have the TV on or your radio on or checking your email a million times or the internet for news, your email. It's oppressive. And so take charge of your life. Today we're talking about stress. You know, that's one of the things you can do. You can decide how much news to watch, how many times to check your email, how many times to do anything that gets you aggravated.
Well, you know, apropos of that, 60 Minutes just did a really good story, if not last Sunday, the Sunday before last, about how these phones and apps are being programmed to addict you. You know, like they did with cigarettes and they've done with other things we actually consume. Well, there are actually this young guy, bless his heart, I forget his name, he actually quit from Google or one of the big enterprises because he had warned them that they were creating apps that were causing you know, people to become addicted to it because of the gain, you know, doing things like the app, like he said, they programmed an app that if you posted something and you got so many responses from it that were positive, rather than just as each response came in, send it to you, the app had actually monitored your behavior and found out when your downtime is. And it would save up the positive responses to notify you always during that downtime. So when you had a downtime and were by habit, you know, you would turn to your phone or check in with that app, boom, all of a sudden you had 10 responses.
Sure.
And it talked about how, you know, the mental gain, the dopamine surge that would cause in the average person, which then again reinforces the person to use the app more, and thereby, and you know, he had many examples.
Are you saying Facebook is a drug?
I'm saying that it's being engineered to
to
monopolize your attention. It's finding ways to draw you in and make you use it more and more. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. It's conditioned because, as you know, dopamine makes you feel better, and
right. And
then after a while, and this is what I see in my practice and with the groups I run, is after a while, the pleasure from getting likes or people signing up and checking you out on LinkedIn or your Facebook and all this kind of stuff and Twitter, and that becomes in many ways instantaneously more rewarding than the real life problems of being in a relationship.
You know, I observed a few months ago, I observed this with a friend who was going through kind of a stressful situation, and they posted something on Facebook, kind of like this is where I'm at thing. And we were out looking for something. We had a project to do. They were checking it like every 30 seconds to see if anybody had responded to the post. And at one point, you know, they got a couple responses. And then later on, I heard them say, oh, nobody's responded. It's been an hour or two. Nobody's. And I thought to myself, and, you know, because I knew they were in such a vulnerable space, I didn't say, you know, you really need to let go of that. And, you know, look at yourself. You're like, she was literally, you know, trying to get, I guess, support, emotional support or affirmation through the phone, through the app, through the Facebook post. And that speaks exactly to what you're saying, Dr. Wish. Rather than calling up a friend and saying, you know, I'm having a bad time today, can we go sit? Or rather than just sitting with me in the car as we travel around looking for a thing and kind of talk this out, you know, she's preoccupied with this this phone and this app.
Yes, and the internet has kind of dulled our ability to discern what is good communication and not. I had clients say to me, oh my God, my fiance broke up with me and ended our engagement through a text message.
And that
what upset her was that he broke it off, not just that he broke it off and did it with a text message. So when I said to her, what's upsetting you? She said, we were planning the wedding, we had a date, we told my parents. I said, what else? I thought this was the one, so I kept asking her what else is bothering her. And finally, after digging through everything, she said, oh, I get it. You shouldn't be texting something like that. Now, that would have been way up at the top of my response.
Right.
So this is what's happening. We're getting numbed out. We're getting dulled. And when I talk to my clients about how to talk to their partners or their children or their supervisors or colleagues at work, the interpersonal skills are going way down.
You know, you're exactly right. The idea of texting sensitive information is getting normalized. I see it in my own life, and it's been a disaster. I mean, my best friend and I discovered this years ago, where we're texting and all of a sudden one of us realizes, whoa, things are getting misinterpreted. And so one of us say, uh-oh, black hole of texting. When can you talk? Because we realize we need to switch to a phone conversation where we can hear each other's tone of voice and you know, the nuances of what we're saying rather than texting. But recently this has happened with in some professional circles where, you know, I'm texting with someone and she wandered into something that was a little more controversial, and I'm looking at this and thinking, what the hell? And then, you know, I finally just had to say, you know what, we need to have a conversation about this, because you know, this is a black hole we're getting ready to go down into. Some people call it the rabbit hole.
It certainly is, and it takes you into the Alice in Wonderland world where everything is sort of distorted. So my first thought of the day, first tip, is go back to real life contact. You know, please, if as much as possible, do it in person, but obviously you can't with people who live far away, but get on the phone or Skype. You know, you can see someone's face. It's as close as you can get to being there without having, you know, to travel someplace. And get over the discomfort and your anxiety. Go ahead and feel sort of out of sorts because you don't have as much control. You know, when you're sending a text, you're in charge. There isn't that back and forth so much. So please try to think about how inappropriate it is for important, sensitive things to be done in texts, and try to make it real as much as possible. Otherwise, you're going to get rusty in reading people, reading your own reactions, and learning how to fine-tune them.
Maybe what we need is a better articulated set of emoticons.
Not
well,
good
that's
all.
What people are using. Seriously. You know, I'm glad you said that because I was
yeah, they upgrade them all the time, John. Have you noticed? They get rid of some and they add others.
More
yeah.
faces.
Yeah, than more faces, right.
That's right.
But, you know, Dr. Wish, before you go there, you used the word control. I wanted to make sure I understood what you were saying. Were you saying that people who are using texting to excess, that it could be a sign of excessive control, trying to excessively control the exchange through texting?
No, what I'm saying is take control of your life, in your real life. Don't give in to all the outlets of other forms of communication that are no longer real, like texting too much, sending an email to someone. Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that your mother died. You know, could you call? You know, oh, go ahead, send an email or a text. But, you know, what about a phone call? Or how about an email or a text saying, let's get together and talk. I really, you know, I want to be there for you.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. Take charge of how much of your life is going to be through these social media outlets.
How much should I send my birthday cards, you know, through the snail mail, or should I send electronic ones? Does that make a difference?
Well, there are so many wonderful electronic birthday cards and other cards now that are animated.
I like Jackie Lawson.
Three-dimensional. To send some cheesy-looking card with a, you know, a cute bunny on it and saying hi, and it kind of feels like you spent less than 2 minutes, you know? You didn't really kind of make a choice, any effort. There's a website. I don't get any money for this, but it's a great website. It's called Jackie Lawson.
And I love her. I love her.
That's John.
You know which one I mean? Okay. Yeah.
Those annoy me. I'm gonna put it out there right now. Disclaimer: the emailing me a birthday card is annoying. I don't care how cute it is, how well done, how technicolor the graphics are. It's like, pick up the phone, call me, sing me a line of happy birthday on my message system.
I got you.
Or send me a card. Send me a little schmaltzy card and add two lines to it of your own.
Take your time. But what I'm saying is, if it's last minute and you've forgotten and the mail is not going to get there, then that's my fallback. As long as it's not some crummy thing.
But you know what, Doctor? You know, my baby sister just apologized for getting me my birthday gift late. And I said to her, a gift is never late.
Right.
Okay.
That's a really great way.
Well,
to
wait a minute.
I agree.
Zaki, I mean, a gift is never late.
A gift is never late.
But an electronic card is never on time. Or never
no,
right.
No, my point was that they annoy me. It's just another email I have to open up from, you know.
Well, true. That's a good point.
My Jackie Lawson cards usually contain a long message, by the way.
In the you know, the 500 emails that have been sent already that I got to wade through and decide which is spam and which is important and which is urgent.
That's a really good point. You're right. When I get a card in the mail, my heart goes, yay.
In fact, you know what, Dr. Wish? I set them aside until I have time to savor them.
Yeah.
You know? Okay. Like, I don't rip
That's
it
sweet.
Open.
Yes.
I set them aside. And, like, you know, I was on traveling while my birthday happened. So I get home and there's all these birthday cards. Well, you know, I had a whole lot of catch-up to do. I finally got around to, you know, the other Saturday when I had some downtime to sit and just open up my cards.
Well, I sent you a Jackie Lawson card. Okay.
And my gift. And my, you know, when I, you know, texted photos of my gifts to my baby sister, said, you rock. You know, I love this. And she said, well, it would have been there on time, but blah, blah, blah. And I said, a gift is never late.
Well, you're right about
that. That's a sweet way. That's a great way to look at it.
That was nice. You know.
She gave me this, she sent me this mug that says, handle stress like a dog. And it has the image of this little dog, right?
Yeah.
And it says, if you can't eat it or play with it, piss on it and walk away.
Right. You know, certain restaurants will insist that you leave anyway, but... yeah.
But, you know, these are all good messages about being real in your life and being present and being connected with yourself. I think these are all good stress reducers, particularly if you've been lucky and smart enough to find people who are part of your cheering team. You don't need millions of friendlies. You need a few really good friends.
Absolutely.
But isn't, you know, I mean, isn't first on the list of stress reducers kind of exercise, like you're doing yoga in the morning, right? And I mean, isn't that the probably the most important thing of all? Not that there's any one thing. I'm not trying to say that, but
I know what you're saying. Yes, it is so important. It's so hard for people to do that, though. You know, there's so many reasons why people don't work out. It's hard for people. There are some people who aren't very good at self-discipline. There are people who just hate it. They never get the satisfaction. There are people who can't afford to drive to some place that, you know, join a membership. There's so many ways to cheat yourself out of being good and being good to yourself. But, boy, once you get into a routine, if you've got some kind of social support, if you begin to feel that it's better to do it than not, it is so important. I there's nothing bad about exercise other than perhaps overdoing it or doing it incorrectly. That's why it's so good to get at least a couple of classes if you can, so you know for sure that you're doing good for yourself. But our nation is tremendously overweight. I think obesity continues to be on the rise, and it's a really serious problem. All you have to do is sit in a mall and watch the people go by. It's terrible, it's scary, and it's very sad.
Well, you know, Dr. Wish, we had a guest on last week, a brilliant woman named Cordelia Gaffar, who has a book and a manual called Exercise Through My Day. And in it, she especially works with busy moms. And the book is full of examples of how to get in just a minute or two of exercise or movement all through the day. I mean, she really, you know, you're changing, you know, the baby's diaper, and you're standing there with it at the changing table, and you kind of rock your hips back and forth, you know, dance a little. All these little tricks. She said she has never. She's raising how many kids? Five kids, John. She has five kids of her own. Four or five kids.
I thought it was seven.
Seven kids.
Oh, that's seven. Right.
Yeah, seven kids. She said she has never had a gym membership. Because she takes every little opportunity to turn it into movement or some form of exercise. You know, she's folding the clothes, and she'll do little half, you know, squats as she's standing there folding clothes, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When my microwave is on and I'm waiting to do something, whatever, or the oven's getting hot, I'll do, you know, or when I'm toasting something in the toaster oven and the seconds go down, I might be doing some kind of exercise. And we have a two-story house, and I go up and down those stairs all the time. I make sure that when I'm coming into the garage with groceries, I carry a bag at a time, so I have to go up and down the steps. Hmm. Or if the bags are really heavy, I'll use them as hand weights. That is so interesting that you said that, because I do that all the time. I maximize these little nanoseconds. I park far away from the, you know, from the grocery store or whatever. Absolutely right. When you're ironing, there's all kinds of things that you can do during the day. Even when you're talking on the phone, you can take a can of soup and do, you know, curls and things like that. But if you aren't disciplined, if you don't value exercise, if you don't work hard to make it part of your life, you won't do these little things.
You know.
And you just won't. And so the longest distance is between doing nothing and starting something. That is always the longest distance. Once you start something, you tend to want to repeat it. And it might be sporadic. And that's why people need help. It could be just calling your best friend and saying, I hate exercising. Will you please stay on the phone with me while I do a couple of Campbell's soup curls? You know, anything you can do to get you to make that distance between doing nothing and starting something easier and easier.
John?
Well, I was just, my wife was saying that this kind of multitasking, well, not so much she says it because she's trying to be generous to me in my old age, but her sisters chime in that men really aren't capable of that kind of multitasking. Like while you're ironing, start planning something else or doing this. Like they have a sort of gender. Their experience says that men aren't that good at that. I mean, is there any gender differentiation here on this?
You know, when you hear things like that, women are more emotional, and I mean, it's think of it as a tendency, but it isn't true for every single person.
Right, okay.
And even if you do have a tendency to do something, it's your responsibility to yourself and probably to your family to do something about it. If you're not good at doing something and it's really important, find ways to make it work. I mean, every night before I go to bed, I write down, I have a list of things during the day that I keep on the counter. And because if I don't write it down, it's gone out of my head. And that's just, you know, you're doing too much.
But are you a good note taker? Like, for example,
yes.
Can when you're interviewing somebody or talking, am I you capable of like almost really just taking notes and like transparently,
yes,
kind of thing? Oh, that's,
yes,
good. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's
definitely
a good talent.
Yes. You know, maybe, you know, quick words for myself, but yes, I can do that. But, you know, find ways that work. That's what makes life less stressful. You can't change everything, but you can make life easier for yourself. And these are not very difficult to do, but once again, it's doing it. And that's where your best friends or siblings or kids or partners, whatever, can help you. Turn to these support team, your cheerleaders, and say, look, will you please help me? I cannot get my closets clean. Will you come over and get me started on this? Because what happens is there's a process that happens in most human beings. It's called the Zeigarnik effect. It was discovered by a woman, and a Russian woman, I think she was a psychologist, that it's a fairly complex process, but the core of it is once you start something, there's a desire to finish it. You don't like the undone thing. So once you get a friend to come over and help you clean out your kitchen cupboard or donate things or go through your closets and decide, you know, what looks good on you or how much laundry you have, whatever it is that you are backing away from and postponing, get a friend to help you or a relative, whoever, one of your cheerleaders, you know, one of your support staff. Get someone to get you going on it. Because once you get going, there's a greater desire usually to do it again and to complete the task.
Yeah, overcoming that inertia,
it
sounds like. Yeah, for sure. You know, I do a lot of my work, paperwork, standing up at a counter. Fortunately, you know, at my house, you know, I have these high counters. And, you know, I have abandoned the office and the desk for standing at the counter doing paperwork. And I understand that a lot of the Fortune 500 companies now have elevated desks. People can stand at their desk. They even have treadmills.
That was Don Rumsfeld's trademark there when he was the defense secretary.
Is that right?
Bush. He always, worked standing up.
He worked standing up. Yeah. And yet they have treadmills where, you know, they go under the desk, and people, you know, they can go very slowly, but people are literally just sort of moving in place, stamping in place as they're working on projects or on the computer and so forth. You know, I got into it because of sciatica. You know, my physical therapist said that the triple culprit are the three bends that we routinely have in our body, at the knees, at the hips, and at the neck. You know, all of them are, you know, at an angle, you know, and by holding that position day in, day out, hours and hours, sitting at a desk, you know, leaning over a desk or a computer, you know, we set in motion lots of chronicity, lots of inflammation, and so forth. So he got me into trying to first buying something that I could elevate my desk with and or working platform with, and there was a learning curve. I can remember initially it felt like, oh God, I can't stand here this long. You know, it felt like it took a lot of energy just to stand up because I was so used to sitting all day. But your body really does adjust pretty quickly. And in time, I found that I don't like sitting down. We're having this conversation, Dr. Wish, and I just got up out of the chair and removed the mic from the stand so I could just stand up and move and extend those joints rather than having them all, you know, engage, all those joints engage while sitting in the chair. And I'm sitting here looking at John all slumped over in his chair and thinking, you know.
I'm practically lying down in my chair.
This is true.
There you go. Well, the recent research on this is that it's good to combine sitting and standing. So as I'm talking to you, I am sitting in a chair in my office because my desk is one of those elevated Varidesks that adjusts from sitting to standing.
Okay.
So I do most of my work standing, and I stand on one of those memory foam type rugs or whatever they are, so that it isn't such hard floors and so hard on my feet.
Right.
But it's good to integrate, you know, make sure you're not doing all day standing or all day sitting. Make sure you do both. And when you are sitting, don't cross your legs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like I do plenty of sitting driving in the car. I do a lot of driving.
Oh, yes.
So,
yes.
So, yeah, when I'm out of the car, I'm standing. Or, you know, I'm laying flat. I'm doing some yoga, some, you know. When I meditate now, I elevate my legs at the knee and lay flat on the floor.
Right, exactly.
Sort of an inversion position.
And it's good to sleep that way. Lie on your back and get a couple of big pillows and keep, you know, sleep as though you're sitting in a chair, but you're lying down with your knees bent and elevated. But the goal here, the theme of this talk this morning, all seems to be about various topics, but the main message is
stress.
Be responsible to yourself. Be responsible for your life. You know, life is short, but it can feel very long and stressful and health compromised. Even though life might be short, all these problems begin to feel like it's very long. And it is so important that you take charge of your life. You know, this is your one shot. You know, who are you? What do you want out of life? What do you need to fix? What do you need to change? If it's too hard to do, you know, do an assessment with yourself. How difficult is it for me to do this? On a scale of 1 to 10, if you're somewhere 5 and above, then go get some help, you know, a friend, join a group, call someone, help, come over, talk to me, give me a pep talk. But the goal is to honor this truly great gift you have of life, and what do you want to do with it?
Yeah, before you called in, we were talking about this recent spate of shootings, all which seem to be by people who just, you know, they just, the stress took them over the brink.
Yes, correct.
And then they made choices that are just, you know, there's no coming back from it. As opposed
to... Yeah, to get to that point of no return, where sitting down and talking to yourself is not going to happen. It's too late. It's just not, you know. I mean, I have a gun in my hand, and I think I better think about this. No, it's way too late. But the important thing here is, I think what you're saying is so, so very valuable. Know your symptoms. Know what your symptoms are that you're stressed. And everyone's symptoms is unique. There's only so many ways that it expresses itself, but your version of it is unique. Are you eating too much or too little? Shopping too much? Spending all your time online buying things? Are you eating, you know, foods that aren't so good for you? Are you stopping at, you know, McDonald's and all the other fast food places and loading up on super carbs? Are you arguing more? Has your sex drive disappeared, or the other side? I had one couple come to see me where every morning the husband wanted sex first thing before that he went to work, every single morning. And the wife came to see me and said, "This isn't lovemaking. This feels like my husband's medicine. Just, I can't take this anymore. You know, it's like I can't take it." And that's what he was using to get the good feelings going. You know, sex is not medicine. You know, it's lovemaking and fun. So think about, you know, what are you doing? Are you sleeping all the time? Are you not sleeping at all? Have you lost interest in life? You know, what's happening? Is your house falling apart? Are you not cleaning? Or is it repairs that need to be made and you haven't done them at all because you can't get going on that inertia thing that you're talking about before, Dr. Saki? So think about it. Your responsibility to yourself and your loved ones is to know yourself and know your signals.
Wow. Yeah. So on the other hand, there's a lot of people that need some help out there. Mm-hmm. Hear people now talk all the time about their, we talked earlier about the can't sleep thing, just because that's probably just a general product of instability in the environment. But I think that I read an interesting study here this morning, actually. Maybe it won't surprise anybody, but it turns out that people's desire or willingness to cooperate is stronger when instability rises.
Correct.
Now, I don't remember all the indices of instability they were looking at, the cooperative principle, so you can learn to help each other effectively, or better, anyway. Maybe you can't solve every problem, but maybe a tendency toward cooperation when stress gets high is something that, I see faith communities do this, okay? They can tell when there's, suicide takes place in a family in their mm-hmm. in their parish or something like that, or some terrible set of illnesses, or a war, or mm-hmm. folks kids going off to conflict. There's kind of waves of effort being made to try and heal the sick and mm-hmm. the grieving, right? And I think that's so there is, you could take it, you don't have to be alone completely in taking responsibility for yourself. Other people may be having problems very similar to yours, or at least complementary, maybe. I don't know.
No, it's true.
The problem is that inertia that Dr. Zaki talked about, that you might feel alone and you might very well create your world of being alone. It's that taking that step to reach out. And sometimes, your family may not be the most supportive. It might be your place of worship. It might be your neighbor. It might be your best friend or a cousin. But reach out. I was thinking when you were talking about what happened in Charleston, South Carolina, when the gunman went in and killed all those people in the church. And the whole community came together. Everybody. I mean, there were so many people afterwards who came together and prayed and sang and came to the day after they had the ceremonies and the burials and the honoring the deceased. I mean, towns can do that, but you can't rely on that happening when you're dealing with getting fired or demoted or transferred to another. The whole town's not going to come to you. You've got to reach out. When people come to see me for whatever is bothering them, they come most often during two times. Obviously, they come when the stress has gotten so bad that they can't take it anymore. But most of the time, they come when their stress and their management of their stress and their ignoring their stress are sort of like a seesaw. It goes up and down. One day they say, oh, it'll be fine. The next day it's terrible. The next day they make a small effort to make changes, but then they can't sustain it. So it's that up and down, going back and forth, that gets people the most motivated to come in for help. They can't tolerate it.
Yeah, right. No, that makes sense. That makes sense.
In my experience, people never come to see a psychiatrist until they're in crisis.
Correct.
They just
otherwise they got to say to their friend, "Where are you going?" "Oh, I'm going to see a psychiatrist." Really? And of course, by the way, I thought maybe. What do you think about instead of the "Are you crazy?" Moniker for the show, because how are you crazy, since we'll assume that there's there's no absolute zero of insanity, and there may not be I don't know whether there's 100% either, but R.D. Lang used to say that the most insane people did have some visions of
They did.
They had some insights, you know, occasionally. So anyway, but I mean, look at that great guy, the guy that did it, that invented the game theory, Nash, right? I mean,
yes, that's
you know,
right.
Kind of an example of. Well, I have a good friend of mine.
Well, Kurt Vonnegut's son, you know, the
Mark,
one that's... Mark Vonnegut,
yeah.
Who has bipolar disorder. His book is called Like Normal, Only More So.
Yeah, right, and, yeah.
And
yeah.
He's got a line in there that I just love, I use, that, you know, he said, a person without an illness is like a boat without a rudder.
Really?
Yeah, really. And what I take from that is that, you know, in my own
life... Is the inverse true?
When I have an illness, yeah, it orients me to where I need to go and how I need to get there. It's a rudder.
Yeah, but is the inverse true?
Without a rudder, if, would you say?
Does that mean if you don't have an illness, you're drifting?
You're drifting, right. Yeah, and you're...
Oh, that's so interesting, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, wow.
Well, a positive spin is that one of the things that human beings and in many ways many primates in general need is just have a sense of mastery over one's environment, over one's life.
Sure.
And so when you have nothing to work on, no goals, no dreams, no tasks, no, small or big, then you have no rudder. You've just given up. And so it doesn't have to be a problem or craziness necessarily, but something that is a challenge to yourself, that's mm-hmm. important to you, mm-hmm. that gives you a sense of mastering.
Yeah, for instance...
Because that's what we need to feel efficacious.
Right. For instance, my sciatica. There's a point when I thought my sciatica was going to be the end of me. Like, I would never really be...
I remember when you were hurting.
Enjoy walking again. And right. I was like...
Oh, that's awful.
You know, I don't want to look forward to, you know, having to go around a little go-kart, you know, in my 60s. But I think that what that sciatica did was it prolonged my mobility for probably another 20, 30 years. Because it got me focused on what am I doing wrong, what's creating this, what created it, what's continuing it, and what do I need to heal it, you know?
No, I hear you. That's
And well, you got proactive.
Exactly.
And that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know, we all have something, right? Everybody in this world has something that they need to face and deal with. And some people, you know, get too much and too many hard things. And if you're lucky, you have things that, you know, are challenges that you can work with. So, again, this goes back to honoring the gift of life. This is your chance. So if you are overweight, if you do have bad knees or sciatica or whatever it is, that is your message. That is your challenge to do something about it. And you did, and you are. But there are so many people who don't.
Yeah, no, it's true. And there are people who need coaches. Like you mentioned, some people get so many things that it's absolutely overwhelming and immobilizing. So they need that coach who's going to say, well, you know what, we're going to work on this first, you know, and get a little improvement there. Because there's a lot to be said about, you know, having little successes. You know, with children in school, you know, it's so important that they have little successes so that they build confidence. Well, the same is true of adults trying something new. To acquire, you know, have little successes and see that, you know, okay, maybe I could do this. You know, maybe this isn't impossible for me to accomplish. You know, the person that weighs 300 pounds, you know.
I'm so glad you said that, because that reminds me of... some of the things I write about. When you have little successes, for example, I deal with a lot of women who are, you know, breaking up with their boyfriends, they had a bad breakup or a divorce, and they don't know how to handle it. They don't know how to handle dating again, how to look at what happened to them. And I'll ask them, let's not talk about this for a moment. Let's talk about other challenges in your life that were big, that really frightened you and kind of threw you off track.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll say something like, well, I had to move to a new town or start a new job or go back to school, you know, something big. And I will ask them, how did you handle that success? So little successes show you what you have internally that are your strengths. And sometimes we forget what we actually did or said to ourselves or how we managed those little challenges, you know, big and small. So having little successes allows you to say, what did I do to get over being nervous giving a talk? What can I do to borrow those techniques to handle this problem now? So little successes are so important, and it's so important to mine them, to use them as your, you know, extra leg to stand on. That's so very important.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, looking back and being able to see that, you know, you were able to handle it, you know.
And how you handle it, because everyone's way of handling stress is, you know, slightly different.
Absolutely.
And then the other side of that is, you also said something very important about dealing with, you know, being afraid to do something and the anxiety of change and new things. And so when I'm dealing with women who are coming off of a very bad relationship and they've done some thinking about it and understand it pretty well, they're still afraid to get back out there and be available to date again. And so I'll say to them, let's not think about dating right now. Let's do something that you've wanted to do that doesn't involve dating, but that you've been afraid to do. And it could be anything, you know, take a language course. One woman wanted to learn how to sing. It doesn't matter what it is, how to roller skate, how to train your dog. It doesn't matter what it is, just something that you've been putting off that makes you very anxious. And so we would, in the group, we would coach everybody and support everybody to do that thing that made them anxious. And then they would come back and have some fits and starts, and eventually they were able to do it. And then I'd say, let's go back now and look at how you overcame the anxiety. What did you do? Now let's see if we can apply that to being afraid to go out and date again. So that's why I'm so glad you mentioned it. Little successes build on big ones.
Yeah, you know, with some of my clients, I've recommended, what were some of the things that you wanted to do when you were coupled that you just couldn't find time for? Or that your partner, you know, was opposed to you doing. You know, I've had a female client or two whose husband, you know, didn't want them going out, taking a dance. He didn't want to take a dance class, but he didn't like the idea of her taking a dance class because she might be there with other men and that sort of thing. So I have encouraged them to do that.
Right.
You know, go do something that, you know, you couldn't do that you wanted to do. And forget about, I don't know, I'm sort of in the magical thinking vein when it comes to relationships, Dr. Wish. I think that it happens when you're not looking.
My best friends are in other countries. that there's a curse.
So let's explore that, okay? A lot of the women say to me in my groups, if it's meant to be, it's meant to be, and if it's just going to happen, it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And my answer to that is, well, maybe you're not understanding what that's about, because the universe is not going to tilt towards you. It just more than likely isn't going to. So what happens to a lot of the women in my research was they got to the point where they said, I'm done. I'm done looking for love. That's it. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen. But what was really going on in them, after we reconstructed it, is that they were letting their anxiety down. They were not so desperate. They weren't so lonely anymore. Mm-hmm. They were, on some level, making an unknown peace with being who they are and where they are. And so when the anxiety goes down, that is often when you send out different signals to people. You're more available. You take small steps towards opportunities, whether it's moving a little bit closer to a guy in you know, the supermarket when you're looking at, you know, what lettuce to buy or something, and suddenly a message is sent, I'm a little bit more available. Or you do things that you didn't think you would normally do, like talk to someone in line. And so what happens is you suddenly increase your chances of making contact with someone being in places where there's a greater sense of contact, like a party or a, you know, Friday night at the bar or something, and then bingo, something happens. You meet someone, and you say to your friends, you know, it was meant to be. It came when I wasn't looking, you know, but you really did many things, tiny little steps that you weren't aware of internally and behaviorally that allowed that to happen.
And then you found out she was married.
Now, John, you can't do that. You can't say that.
That's okay. I'm just, you know, that's my job.
No, you know that John kind of segues to some
little black cloud.
Well, see, I was going to go there here. You know, guys talk and guys will say, man, you can tell when some, you know, a chick is over eager or she's got that desperate look in her eye, you know, and that's unattractive. That, you know, to a lot of people, that's unattractive. But the one who looks like, I could take it or leave it, you know, I'm feeling fine just the way I am. Are the attractive one. There's the one. And so you know, guys sometimes say, yeah, so why is it we're so attractive when we're already coupled or we're married? How come we get all this attention?
Well, once, now, if you're a woman, it's a different. It might be a different reason than with a guy. Now, with a guy, James Bond, for example, used to say all the time that just made it easier to move on, right? You know, if it was a married woman. On the other hand, you know, if you're looking at the married guy, maybe you're saying, "Well, gee, I like it. What do I like about him?" Well, it may be that he managed to stay married. something like that,
Somebody wanted pay the bills. It. Somebody or, wants him.
You know, pay the bills or you know, keep it together, whatever. And you know, it could be something as simple as that you like, that you admire, or that you feel that it's attracts true. You.
Right? I agree.
Even though it's not, you know, can't work or whatever.
Dr. Wish, we got 2 minutes. Weigh in.
There you go.
Well, let's talk about, we're talking about stress and anxiety. You know, if you're single, male or female, studies have shown that the more attractive people, and the more you are more eager, and you've got, for women, you've got your sexiest clothes on, and for men, you've got, you know, a shirt unbuttoned down, as my grandmother used to say, all the way down to your business. those are turnoffs. You're too eager. Too eager. Mm-hmm. Research has shown that the woman who gets talked to at the bar, the guy who gets approached at the bar, the most attractive, sexy clothes are T-shirts and jeans. Regular, ordinary looking.
You mean there's actually data on that?
Yes, there is.
Oh, my God.
The most attractive woman at the bar does not get the most hellos or the most men going up to her because it's too intimidating. The average person with a good smile, you know, weight according to height, and, you know, average looks, you know, a smile on a face and a glow makes an average person look really good.
Yeah,
that's true. I agree. And a scowl on a pretty woman makes her look ugly.
Yes.
Well,
and a woman with too much on says gold digger.
Now wait a minute, Marlena Dietrich was.
You call that a scowl?
Well, it was a. Let's call it a skepticism.
It was a Mona Lisa smile.
Okay. All right. Okay. Like, I'm with you.
Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe not. Maybe. Maybe not.
Right. Right. Okay. I don't know. Anyway, well, Dr. Wish, this has been wonderful again. It's just we love talking to you. I'm so glad you don't mind talking to us. I mean, we're located here in a state that doesn't have enough people in it left. It's probably going to turn into a colony pretty soon, but it's up for sale. We need money. We haven't got any money in this state at all. So anyway, but thank you so much for helping out.
Well, I'm glad it is seen as help because I don't know, and I'm so happy to speak with you. I love our conversations. I like that they flow, and it's very important to me that I just don't talk to you, but I make sure that your listeners get some doable tips.
Right. No, you're one of our. I get email all the time about you, and it's interesting. You know, I've had people that just couldn't handle your advice at some point, like that maybe you shouldn't have sex on the first date. I think you said that at some point, mate.
That's right.
You probably, you know, I had some, I remember I got some feedback on that one about how No way. Kind of thing, you know. But anyway, but I just, it's been, I think people like to have a show. I've heard a lot of times where you can, you know, let it hang out, you know, talk about things that are going on in people's families every day. And it resonates a little bit. People maybe don't feel like it's just their problem. And I think that's
exactly
first step toward
and
helping.
So what is really wrong with sex on a first date? It's like making a decision that's important in your life in ways that you may not know while you're really drunk. So why would you do that? Sex hijacks your brain. It ramps up all those pleasure hormones, and you lose your capacity of becoming an agent in your own life.
Absolutely.
Dr. Leslie Beth Wish, you can find her at lovedickvictory.com online. And
that's Love Victory.
Love Victory.
Not Love Dick Victory. Lovevictory.com.
Lovevictory.com. And we'll look forward to you again on May 17th.
That is great. And if you go to my website, Love Victory, sign up, and you'll get some gifts, and you'll be automatically put on my list for my intuition workshops.
All right. All right. Thanks, Dr. Wish.
Thanks a lot, guys.
All right.
Okay.
Take care.
Happy and well.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. That's been the Are You Crazy Show, Health and Wellness Wednesday here on enlightenradio.org. Coming up in about an hour is going to be legendary organizer Stuart Acuff's Resistance Radio or Resistance News, and Bill Fletcher, another longtime activist in both the labor, civil rights, equality, international solidarity, anti-apartheid. And I think Bill's done everything, you know. So he's going to be calling in, I think, too. Talk with Stuart, and we'll be back at that time. In the meantime, take care of each other. It's late, but everything comes next.